Nacho Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to those of you that don't speak Italian. I am thrilled that you joined us for episode 21 of the Calcio Land podcast. So I am joined by my great friend and producer, Alex Goldberg. And Alex, I have to tell you, good thing we're going first and that we have Dre Cordero, who has an amazing interview that we just recorded, going last, because we would have not been able to follow that up for sure. So, guys, just stay on and listen to the whole episode. You are going to be blown away by the second part. So, Alex, one thing that we've spoken a lot about on the podcast in recent weeks is the Donnarumma saga. So today, at least in the short term, we got some closure. Today he finally signed the contract, went to Casamilan, posed with some fans, and it seems like slowly but surely things might go back to normal for him there. So I wanted to get, now that the soap opera, at least for now, is over, I wanted to get your final thoughts on everything that we saw happen.
Well, David, it looks like I learned two things with this whole Donnarumma saga. The first thing I learned is if Mino Raiola is the agent of the player, nothing is official until that club posts on Twitter. I know it sounds superficial, but until they post on Twitter that they have officially signed the player or extended the player, and of course I'm kind of hinting at the Lukaku situation as well, nothing with Mino Raiola is done until it is officially done. And then the other thing I learned was, you know, I think you always say, you know, when we talk, especially when we do the Twitter questions, you always try to remind fans, and really it reminds me as well, that these players actually are people and they have personal lives and they have things going on. And sometimes we might just think to ourselves, oh, well, why didn't he come to this club? Like, all of the stars aligned, he should have just went there. But I often forget about they have personal lives, they have kids, they have wives, girlfriends, everything, parents. So with the Donnarumma situation, you know, obviously he made some Milan fans upset by rejecting the initial deal and all that, but the kid is 18 years old, and I stress kid. It's very hard to judge any player now, at least for me, you know, on where they decided to go and why they signed for this money, because I'm just not in their position. If I was getting millions of dollars thrown at me, I can't say what I would do until I'm in that situation. And by the way, if anybody wants to help me out, I'll gladly think about it. But anyway, it's one thing to judge like a 25-year-old on the money that's being thrown at them, but Donnarumma is obviously a child in comparison. You know, he's a fan at heart, still a huge fan of obviously AC Milan. So there's a lot of, you know, forces going at each other. The money versus being the star of the franchise and having a crazy agent. So I think I just learned, let's not judge kids too much, because boy, are they not on a heavy foundation of years lived. And also, if Mino Raiola is the agent, don't take anything as a sure thing. David, how did you feel about the whole soap opera?
I agree with a lot of what you said. And, you know, we've talked a lot about it. For me, you know, the takeaway for this is that, you know, and this is not even maybe unfortunately, but to me, the reality is passion for players and teams is mainly for fans. And for players, it's a business, ultimately. So the way I see it, the soap opera for now is over. It's going to be very interesting to see how Milan fans are going to react to him in the first few games. I'm also very curious to see how the fact that his wages, you know, $6 million net of taxes, how that's going to impact other players on Milan. Not that long ago, Mino Raiola negotiated an extension for Bonaventura, who's about 10 years older. He's getting $2 million net, so a third of Donnarumma. Granted, that was negotiated with Galliani. So I'm curious to see what happens with that. I think for Milan, obviously, the advantage is they kept Donnarumma for 1 year, at least one more season. If he does leave, you know, there's this exit clause for $80 million. That's probably $30, $40 million more than they would have gotten this summer. The only downside of not selling him this summer abroad, we know Real Madrid and PSG could have been potential destinations, is there's still the chance that he could go to Juve. I'm just very curious to see, though, how fans are going to react to him in the meantime, but I'm glad that at least for the time being, we can move on from the Donnarumma saga. And let's just do it right now by getting to the great Twitter questions that we received. The way you send them in, you know, by now is just using the Calcioland hashtag, and we'll do our best to answer all of them on the podcast. So, Alex, which ones did you pick for today?
All right, so this first one is a nice change of pace. We're constantly talking, and you're being asked about players that are, you know, heavily rumored. But, David, who is one player in Serie A who isn't in transfer news headlines, but who would make a great addition elsewhere?
So I'm going to give you three players. I'm going to cheat a little bit. So you guys know all the big names, of course. I'm going to give you one, Atalanta midfielder Freuler. I think he doesn't get a lot of hype because Gagliardini, who was there at Atalanta, went to Inter, did so well. Frank Kessie, who's now at Milan after being linked to Premier League teams, rightfully get a lot of hype. But I think he's a very, very good modern midfielder, can do a little bit of everything. Another player is on Sampdoria, Torreira. I know Matteo Bonetti spoke about him as well, compared him to Vidal a little bit. I can definitely see a lot of that in him. I hope Sampdoria is able to hold on to him one more season. I think he'd really benefit from playing there for manager Gianpaolo one more year. And the last one is Walter Birsa from Chievo. You know, I always talk about him as one of the most underrated players in Serie A, one of the last true natural trequartisti that you see in Serie A, and to me, one of the most underrated players. Like, he's almost a one-man offense for Chievo.
Okay. All right, moving on. Next Twitter question. Do you think Patrick Schick will join Juventus despite the complications, and what will Douglas Costa bring to Juventus?
So Patrick Schick took a medical with Juve about 3 weeks ago again. So he took what was called the first part of the medical, and that lasted 6 hours, which in and of itself has caused a concern. And that wasn't even the full medical. After that, he went back to wrap up the under-21 Euro in Poland. The expectation was once that finished, he would just come back to Juve and they would make the deal official. So that hasn't happened. So there are a couple of theories on what that is. You know, one, it could be a physical problem. Again, that medical took a long time. The other thing is maybe Juve uncovered something in the medical that isn't that troublesome that they want to drop out of the deal altogether, but maybe they want to reevaluate the valuation. So Schick technically had a 25 million euro exit clause. Juve offered to pay 30 million. The caveat for that is they would get Schick right away. Sampdoria was hoping someone would pay the 25 million and keep him there on loan. And Juve was like, you know what, we'll just pay extra and we'll just bring him here right away. So if I gone to the head, you know, and I don't have too much information, my guess is maybe now Juve still wants to keep him and maybe sent him on loan to Sampdoria to finish the season, and they look at the finances of the deal again and maybe lower that a little bit, or maybe tie it to bonus to numbers of games played. So as far as Douglas Costa, this has been a roller coaster of a ride. So he finally took the medical. That deal should be made official shortly if it hasn't already, since we've been recording. I always tie the Douglas Costa to kind of Dani Alves. They don't technically play the same role, but I've always said, you know, what Juve needs to replace with Dani Alves are his performances in the Champions League when he played as an offensive winger. I think Douglas Costa can absolutely do that. Today, Dani Alves signed with PSG. I got to be honest, I think a lot of Juve fan have ex-girlfriend syndrome where, you know, it's an ex-girlfriend that you still deep down really love and care for, and you find reasons to trash her to kind of deal with that. Seeing a lot of negative comments on Dani Alves, but I think in the Champions League, he made a big difference. So here's hoping that Douglas Costa can do the same for Juve fans, because really, at this point, we have to judge Juve mainly in the Champions League, and I think he'll be able to help there.
Definitely. I'm seeing a lot of Dani Alves quotes from his PSG press conference today, and some Juventus fans are not taking them well. All right, next Twitter question, David. Do you think Ivan Perisic would be a good addition for Manchester United?
So this is a shameless opportunity for me to give an update on Perisic and Alexandro, because every time we have a podcast and we don't talk about them, we get yelled at. So look, for both of them, it's basically the status quo. Manchester United has yet to meet Inter's asking price for him. They're not that far off. Inter, you know, would like to keep him. Seems like Perisic wants to go to Manchester United. So it sounds like, you know, push comes to shove. If Man United adds a few million, this deal is going to happen. I've said all along, I think it'd be a great addition for Manchester United. The reason I say that is I think it's hard to envision a more ideal winger for Mourinho. Sure, Alexis Sanchez, fantastic offensively. Perisic, you know, isn't on that level offensively, but he's really no slouch offensively. When I talk about the fact that he's a complete winger that's very good defensively, I don't want people to assume that he's trash up front, because he's far from it. I recommend people watch him, some highlights maybe when he played with Croatia in international tournaments. Like, he's a devastating player, and I think he'd be a really good addition for Manchester United. And, you know, as far as Alexandro, update's still the same. You know, Chelsea had made a bid. There really hasn't been much movement since. Juve would like to keep him. So let's see what happens there. There really haven't been updates either way with Alexandro, so we'll have to wait and see.
All right, moving on. We talked about this team a lot on Monday. David, where does Fiorentina stand with their goalkeeper position?
And shout out to Chloe Beresford. It was her first real podcast. I know she was really nervous. She did an outstanding job, and we got great feedback on that episode. So shout out to her. She did really well. So also shout out to Roberto Grosso, who sent this question. He always sends us questions on goalkeepers. Some of them are like obscure, from Serie B, and that shows my lack of knowledge of that league. So I wanted to answer this one. I think now at this point, Fiorentina is going to go all in on Sportiello, who used to be at Atalanta. Wasn't long ago that he was considered as a potential replacement for Buffon, both at Juve and on the Italian national team. I think he has a lot of potential. Last season, he really struggled. He got into some arguments with Atalanta's manager, Gasperini. Never really recovered for him from that. Fiorentina signed him, and I think he's going to have a very, very good season. So I think they're going to go with Sportiello, and I think they're going to reap a lot of rewards with that.
All right, this next one is the big one for me, at least. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang or Alvaro Morata to Chelsea, who would be a better fit for Chelsea?
I'm going to put you on the spot, Alex, in a second and get your thoughts as well. So let me comment in general on the rumors. You know, I don't like to talk too much about other sites. As far as I know, he's really not on Chelsea's radar at the moment. Again, with all due respect, maybe other people are right about this. As far as I know, the situation with him is Milan would love to sign him. Paolo Cannavaro's club in China would love to sign him. Good news for Milan is the transfer window in China closes on Friday, so we'll know by then if he doesn't sign with them. There'll be an opportunity for them to close the deal, or maybe it's an opportunity for Chelsea or other clubs to jump in. I don't know him that well. I'll tell you, Morata for a Conte team would be fantastic. We've talked about it on the podcast ad nauseum that he tried to bring him to Juve before he resigned. His track record in the Champions League is fantastic, and I know Chelsea and especially Conte, who really wants to like change his brand in Europe, I could see him going for him. What are your thoughts, though, on Aubameyang? You, as a Chelsea fan, would you be excited if they sign him?
I mean, I'd be beyond excited, because just judge him by himself. He's a phenomenal player who's obviously blowing up the Bundesliga, and he's one of my favorite players. I do agree Morata's probably a better system fit. The thing that I would love about Aubameyang on Chelsea is I always think you should build around your best players, and Eden Hazard, in my opinion, is Chelsea's best player. And he's really never – he's worked with Costa and Fabregas, obviously, at Chelsea, Juan Mata briefly. But he's really never played with a player like Aubameyang, someone who's that dynamic. And I have pulled so much hair out, David, with some of the brilliance that Eden Hazard's had, where he's crossed the ball across net and there's been no one there to meet it. Diego Costa is okay at that, but Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang might be the best poacher in the world right now in terms of how he slides into goal, and he would be on the end of a lot of Hazard crosses. But overall, I actually do agree. I think Morata is a better fit for Chelsea's system, so I'm not going to get too excited about it. I know you said Aubameyang right now is a little bit far-fetched. So moving on, which team will be the biggest surprise and biggest disappointment in Serie A next season?
I'm going to give you the biggest surprise. To me, a lot of people are sleeping on Napoli, and I know they finished third, and you know, they've been really good for a while. But I think because of their lack of like big transfers, there's been all Milan in the headlines, Juve making moves, Spalletti going to Inter and them starting to make some moves on the transfer market. But for me, Napoli, just keeping Mertens and Insigne, it looks they're going to keep Koulibaly. They have all those great young midfielders. I think a lot of people are sleeping on them. I actually think, you know, Juve obviously deserves to be the favorite, but I actually think Napoli is going to give them a run for their money this season. A less obvious choice for a team that I think is going to surprise people is Torino. I thought last summer Torino was the hipster team because of all their signings offensively. I pointed to the fact that they had lost three starters on defense and added Joe Hart, and their defense was terrible. And I wasn't surprised. Lord knows I'm wrong a ton, as people on Twitter like to remind me. But on that, I had no doubt. I thought people really overrated Torino. But this summer, they're really working on addressing those weaknesses. They signed Sirigu from PSG to be their goalkeeper. That would be a very intriguing option. They brought in this Brazilian prospect center back, Lianco, who had been linked to some other big clubs. They are looking at some other defenders, Acerbi, who's at Sassuolo, Paletta, and Zapata, who played for Mihailovic at Milan. So I think it's smart for Torino to really look at defense. Let's see what happens with Belotti as that 100 million exit clause. If for whatever reason Chelsea doesn't sign Morata, maybe they'll go for him. But even if he were to leave, they've targeted Simeone's son, who plays for Genoa as a replacement, and he actually did really well. I could see him striving at Torino. As far as a team that I think is really going to struggle, we talked a lot about them on Monday, Fiorentina. I could see absolute chaos there. This was similar to in the early 2000s after they sold some players. I think they even went bankrupt at a point. I'm not saying they're going to go down to that level, but I think Fiorentina fans have a big reason for concern as things stand.
Okay, David, last Twitter question. When was the last time you can remember an overhaul like this one at Milan?
So not surprisingly, and here I'm going to date myself, and I'm clearly old. The last time there was a change in ownership at Milan, when Berlusconi took over, the team was really down in the dumps. You think Milan was bad in the past few years? Back then, they were far worse. So it's not surprising that when Berlusconi came in, he radically changed the team, made a lot of investments, kind of what we're seeing now. So I think that's going to bode well for them. Let's give like a quick transfer update on Milan while we're on the topic. You know, they're still negotiating with Lazio for Biglia. They're not that far off on the final price, but Lazio's president, Lotito, is very, very stubborn. He talked about Aubameyang as a potential target. The new name today is Gidzal, who his agent was at Casa Milan today. So expect at least 2-3 more moves from Milan, and their fans have great reasons to be excited. So thank you all for the questions. Thank you, everyone who leaves reviews. Thank you for sharing our podcast with your friends. We rely on you to be our advertising, and we really appreciate it. So next up, we have an incredible interview with Dre Cordero, who is Matteo Bonetti's partner calling Serie A games on BN Sports. So I've known Dre a little bit. I've been following him a lot. Obviously, the games that he calls, I've seen how much he's gotten into Serie A. And when we had Matteo on, he kept telling me, he goes, listen, Dave, you need to have Dre on your show. And I was like, absolutely. And when I started talking to him, I was like, why haven't we had this guy sooner? So we got into really an amazing conversation. I thoroughly encourage you to listen to the whole thing because you'll learn a lot. And so I want to thank all of you for listening and your support with the podcast. Okay, as you guys know by now, favorite part of the podcast for sure for me is the interview. I have a feeling it's the same for you guys, so you don't hear me talk as much. And today we are joined, we're very excited to have our good friend Dre Cordero. We've had Matteo Bonetti on a few times, and Dre is his partner on BN Sport USA calling Serie A games. So in today's interview, we're going to get into, of course, his experience covering the Italian league. We're going to talk to as well about his career. I know a lot of you guys out there are interested in becoming the next Dre Cordero. And then we're also going to get in a very exciting tangent on the psychology of being a football fan and supporting different teams. I think you guys are really going to enjoy that part. So Dre, thank you so much for joining us. We're thrilled to have you on CalcioLand with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm touched to have been invited. I know Mateo speaks really highly of you, and I've been listening to the podcast. You're doing a terrific job, so thanks so much for the invite.
Fantastic. So, Dre, let's start with your day-to-day job. You know, we'll get into your career, and you've covered a lot of leagues previously. I know you mainly from the great jobs you do calling Serie A matches. So tell me a little bit, what's your favorite aspect of calling an Italian football game, and what do you think sets apart Serie A from other leagues?
Well, I think via Twitter, you've made it clear that you've seen me sort of, you know, gradually, absolutely fall head over heels with Serie A from the time I started covering it to, you know, covering it seriously on a week-to-week basis to where I'm at now. So I think you've sort of seen the progress of me. Oh, this is cool. Oh, this is amazing. Okay, now I'm obsessed with this. And one of the things that has made me obsessed with Serie A is it helps me, Italian football and especially, helps me learn about the game in a way that maybe other leagues don't really afford you. What I mean by that is, Max Allegri said this almost as a detriment to the league, but I think it speaks highly of it. He said that it's too tactically rigid. I think Serie A is where you sometimes get to see the chess match of football better than you would in, say, you know, the English Premier League or even Spain's La Liga, where it's more about, you know, sort of individual quality at times. And so what Allegri had said was that you could you know, show up at the beginning of the game, write down the tactical lineups, just where everybody's sitting, take a one-hour nap, come back, and everyone's in the same position. And so he meant that, obviously, to the detriment of the league. I think there's something wonderful about that, of being able to see that contrast of style, even if you don't have the most trained eye. And so covering Serie A, watching Serie A, has actually taught me more about football than, you know, the 8 years that I spent covering La Liga, for example.
Fantastic. I couldn't agree more. And yeah, I've certainly seen you evolve in a full-blown Serie A junkie, and I look forward to meeting you at a Calcio Anonymous meeting very soon. So you mentioned you enjoy, obviously, the tactical aspect. I couldn't agree more. To me, it's no surprise that the best managers tend to be Italian. The Italian, I think, Coverciano, the school where, you know, students go to become, to get the license to be a manager in Italy, to me, is like the Harvard and the Oxford of coaching. So speaking of teams that you like watching and calling, is there maybe a team or two that you enjoy watching more than others?
I think this question probably came with a little bit of intel from my commentary partner and your friend, Matteo Bonetti, because last season I couldn't shut up about Napoli to anyone that would listen. And it, for very much the same reason as I told you, I really enjoy Serie A when you see this sort of contrast of styles and how apparent the tactics are from someone like, you know, Spalletti to Allegri. For me, the brand of football that I saw from Maurizio Sarri's Napoli was something that after Pep Guardiola's Barca, I didn't think I was going to see again for a decade. And it really is just amazing joy to watch. And so if you allow me to get like a little bit philosophical for a minute about tactics in football in Serie A, in football at its sort of natural state is chaos, and the lower the level of the vision that you're watching, the more chaotic it looks. And for anybody who's seen sort of a, you know, low level NCAA, you know, college soccer game, you can see how apparent that chaos is. So what do you do with that chaos at the top level managers? You know, you got guys like Jose Mourinho who decide, well, I want to take care of the area closest to my goal and try and keep that chaos as far in front of me as I can so that, you know, if the chaos isn't close to my own goal. You have managers like the more, you know, German style of football, like, say, Jurgen Klopp, who try to use that chaos almost like jiu-jitsu, right? They want to press it up against the opposition's box with gegenpressing, you know, pressing up to try and win the ball back as high as possible and cause mistakes there. And then you have someone like Maurizio Sarri, who I draw parallels to, you know, Guardiola, to Marcelo Bielsa. These are guys who seek to eliminate that chaos by taking control of the ball, by taking possession, by employing this positional attacking football style where Marek Hamšík picks up the ball. He knows exactly where Lorenzo Insigne is going to be. He knows exactly where Dries Mertens is going to be. He knows where Diawara is going to be. And so it allows players to play from memory almost. And so that positional possession-based attack for me is just so aesthetically pleasing. It's so beautiful to watch that you almost don't want to call it sport. It's almost performance art. And so when I watched Napoli, Sarri's Empoli, for example, that's where I really realized, well, there's something special about Maurizio Sarri, is watching the transition from, you know, his Empoli to his Napoli. It's the exact same brand of football. The only thing that changed is the quality of the players in Napoli is obviously higher than the quality of the players. Not that he didn't have a good squad at Empoli, but, you know, there's no comparison between the two. But you watch an Empoli game when Sarri was there and a Napoli game when Sarri was there, and the ideas are so obvious, so clear what he's trying to transmit, and the aesthetics are more or less the same. And so for me, what makes a good manager, I want to be able to see that the coaches' ideas, the managers' ideas are being transmitted to the players as clearly as possible. And I think nowhere is that more evident than Maurizio Sarri's Napoli.
Alex, mark that down. This is my favorite answer we've gotten on the podcast from anyone. So I totally agree with that. I'm going to tell you a quick story. My first exposure to Sarri, you know, when Empoli came to Serie A, everyone was telling me, this guy's amazing. This is like Arrigo Sacchi all over again. And the first time I actually watched Empoli play, I was in an Italian prison. No, I wasn't detained. I was there to cover a game between prisoners. And I was watching Empoli, and I was absolutely blown away. And since then, I've been obsessed with Sarri as well. So we agree as far as the coach, who the most fun is to watch. But as far as players, which one really stood out to you? And maybe not just big names, players maybe some of our listeners may not be that familiar with.
Just one quick thing, by the way, on Sarri. I'm going later tonight to watch Miami FC play against Cincinnati in a U.S. Open Cup game. Nesta, who's managing Miami FC, who just won the NASL title, by the way, is such a huge Sarri admirer. You can see that they're trying to do the same thing in NASL that Sarri does, where it is possession-based football. It is playing it out of the back. So it's having repercussions even in the NASL in American football, because Nesta is apparently a very big admirer. In terms of players, you know, the quality of Serie A has just been steadily rising. And the attacking play in Serie A has just been phenomenal. So I look at sort of creative midfielders as kind of where I put my focus when I'm not calling a game, when I'm just sitting back to enjoy a game. And so I mentioned Napoli. I think Marek Hamšík is an incredible player and maybe a little bit undervalued, certainly outside of Italy. From everybody, you hear the word, you know, world-class tossed around a lot. And I wanted a more strict definition of world-class. What does that world-class mean? It can't just be very, very good, right? There has to be some way to narrow that down. And so I sort of came up with my own definition of world-class. And for me, world-class is a player that I can take and put into the starting 11 of just about any team on the planet, and he won't look out of place. And I feel like that's an acceptable definition of world-class. You can put him into any team on the world, he'll break the starting 11. I think Hamšík, and some people will think I'm crazy for this, I think Hamšík would get there. He could play at Bayern, at Barca, at Madrid, at Juve, it doesn't matter. Napoli are obviously very happy to have him. Guys like Rajan Nainggolan, for example, and the mm-hmm. development of Rajan Nainggolan from his days at Cagliari to the player he's become now. We've seen him score some incredible blockbuster goals with his right, with his left, from distance, volleys. And that's not even the main part of his game. He plays at an intensity that is just unmatched. I mean, even if he didn't have the funny hair, you could pick out Rajan Nainggolan just by, he's the guy working harder than everybody else on the pitch most of the time. And one guy who's been in the news a lot, who's been one of my favorite players for a long time, Borja Valero. Obviously, it's been sort of an unfortunate end to his Fiorentina days to the benefit of Inter. But those three midfielders in particular have been some of my favorite players to watch in Serie A. And if you look at the attack, I mean, I think the promise of Paulo Dybala is the kid has no ceiling. I mean, he probably hasn't developed as quickly or as I would have liked, or as much as maybe the hype would warrant. Granted, he might be playing a little bit out of position. But when we saw that that Palermo team with Paulo Dybala and Franco Vasquez, who just those two alone would unlock really good Serie A defenses, I thought, well, Paulo Dybala is going to be an absolute superstar within like 2-3 years' time. He is. He's still an incredibly top player. He's now finally breaking in. It looks like he's finally breaking into the Argentina national team now with the new coach Sampaoli. But I would have hoped that he would have taken sort of that role at Juve as being, you know, their main player a little bit sooner. Maybe because I like Paulo Dybala so much, my expectations of him are a little bit higher than most. But I look at him as maybe my favorite attacker in Serie A.
Awesome. So, yeah, and I think, you know, Dybala, a lot of people are going to remember that final in Cardiff where he basically disappeared. But I agree. I think, you know, if there's one player that's poised to maybe end the run, the Ballon d'Ors after, he'd be a very good choice. So, Dre, we've talked a lot about Serie A players that you enjoy watching in Italy. Do you think there's a reason why we see many of them go abroad, especially in England, and struggling? A lot of them then return to Italy with the tail between their legs and then do very well in Italy. Do you think that means those other leagues are better, or are there some reasons that might be a little bit more nuanced?
I can't imagine that it's because they're better, especially if you're talking about going to England, because English players tend to struggle away from England or tend not to travel so much away from England. You don't really get, at least not in the modern game, English players really thriving in Serie A or La Liga or the Bundesliga at the moment. I do think some players struggle. You look at guys like Alessio Chelsea, but that also happens to Spanish players. I mean, Iago Aspas, who was phenomenal for Celta Vigo this last season and was terrific before he went to Liverpool, really struggled in England as well. I think there's some guys who have done well, some Italians. And for example, Marco Verratti, you know, it's harder to do better. It's hard to do better than he's done at PSG. Obviously, the interest in Barcelona would validate that. I think Mario Balotelli sort of rediscovered his football at Nice. Andrea Raggi, I'm pretty confident you would not expect me to bring up the name Andrea Raggi on this podcast, but he somehow managed to stay relevant at Monaco and showed a lot of leadership for the team that turned out to be the Ligue 1 champions. Nicola Sansone took La Liga by storm. Maybe by storm is a little bit over-exaggerating, but he was terrific at Villarreal. And I mean, you know, you look at someone like Giuseppe Rossi, who, if not for the injuries, you know, could be one of those guys who really speaks highly of Italian football abroad, even if he was born in New Jersey. Angelo Bona at West Ham before he got injured was doing really well. So you're right. I think the perception and the trend is, yeah, they don't do great. Alessio Cerci comes to mind and they have to come back. But there are guys who have thrived elsewhere. I think maybe the big disparity is, why do Italian managers do so well and maybe the same level of success hasn't sort of translated to the players?
Excellent. So before we get into some of the topics that you and I talked about on the phone on Monday, you cover Serie A. You've mentioned that the more you've been watching it, you've really become a full-blown junkie like me. But what do you think the league needs to do to market itself better abroad and with fans that may not be that familiar with the league and that dismiss it, Juve is going to win it anyway, who cares? What do you think the league can do to improve their branding?
That's a very good question, actually, and one that I'm very much invested in because 80-85% of the games I call at BN Sports are Serie A games, and I want people to watch as much as possible. I want the profile of the league to be raised as high as possible. I think, obviously, you know, not from a marketing aspect, but from a football aspect, it helps to do well in Europe. I think the fact that Juve have been to a couple of Champions League finals recently, you know, speaks really well. I think the way that Napoli went out against Real Madrid with their heads held high speaks really well and does call attention. I think the way that the goal scoring numbers have gone up and the attacking play has gone up over the last decade in Serie A speaks really well. But from a marketing standpoint, it does seem to sort of lag behind other leagues. And it doesn't help when you have, you know, four or five games kicking off at the same time on a Sunday, especially if, you know, for the international audience, those games are conflicting with, you know, La Liga or on a Saturday, you have a couple of games at the same time as maybe some Premier League games. That doesn't help. And so I think, if I remember correctly, Serie A are working toward changing that a bit, toward moving the schedule around a bit, which would help tremendously, I think, because I don't think the product needs improvement. I think the product is terrific. I think maybe the exposure, the fact that you don't have, you know, Juve, Roma, and Napoli all playing at the same time in different games would help. So hopefully they'll get the scheduling sorted out. That aside, I think it's just going to take, you know, a little bit of time and a little bit of success in Europe for people to really catch on to. Because when you look at what Napoli did in the Champions League, sure, they crashed out against Real Madrid, but that was such a great advertisement for Italian football, the way they played.
Couldn't agree more.
And hopefully that'll pay into, you know, higher ratings and more people watching our channel.
Absolutely. And yeah, and you're after already this segment, you can come back on this podcast anytime to promote this. So when you and I started chatting about having you on the show, you brought up a topic that you wanted to discuss. And I think people just hearing your first few answers understand that you're like a philosopher, savant. And we talked on Monday, and you know, one thing that you see on Twitter a lot are people arguing on rating players or even talking about the same game. And one thing that you often see on Twitter to dismiss someone is like, you know, we must be watching different games as kind of an insult. And we chatted about this on Monday, and there actually are some reasons where two people could literally be watching the same programming on TV, the same match, but they are in a way watching a completely different game. So tell me a little bit how you would describe this phenomenon, because what you told me on Monday was really fascinating, and I want to share this with our listeners.
Well, I'm fascinated by you know, cognitive bias. I'm fascinated by neuroscience. I'm not by any means a scientist or a psychologist, but it's something that I, you know, being the loser that I am, do read up on in my free time. I love studies that tell us, you know, why we behave as idiotically as we do so often, right? And so why we believe what we believe has been something that I've studied for a long time. Because my starting point is this: we don't have access to why we believe what we believe. A lot of that stuff happens sort of at the subconscious level, and then we consciously reverse engineer the reasons why. And when we arrive at the one that makes sense, when we find the story we can tell ourselves, we accept that as the reason why we believe what we believe. I'm not going to go too, you know, far off the deep end in that side, but it gives you sort of some background of where I begin with this sort of cognitive bias stuff. And sports has actually been a really good place to study cognitive science and to study cognitive bias and self-delusion. FAN, obviously, is short for fanatical. People don't act reasonably often in sports. And there was this one particular study in 1951 that was done at Dartmouth and Princeton that sort of launched all of these studies into self-delusion, where there was this particularly violent college football game between Dartmouth and Princeton. This was back when both schools were relevant footballing schools. Dartmouth's quarterback, I believe, was a Heisman, maybe the last Ivy League quarterback to win a Heisman Trophy. And these two teams faced off at the last game of the season. It was a particularly violent game. I mean, it turned out to be a bloodbath. And in the lead up after, or in the week following that game, there seemed to be these very different accounts based on whether you're reading a Dartmouth newspaper or a Princeton newspaper, hearing Dartmouth fans or Princeton fans. And it felt as if it sounded like they were watching a completely different game. And so these two psychologists, one from each school, thought, okay, well, there must be something to this. And obviously the two sets of fans remember it differently, but what if we can show them the game again? What if they can watch a broadcast of the game? Would they experience it differently in real time? And as it turns out, they did. So what they did is they had them fill out this questionnaire, and as they were watching the game, these two sets of fans, groups of fans, would mark down every time they saw an infraction or a foul and the severity of the foul. And so afterwards, these two psychologists would study the comparisons between the two. And it turned out that, you know, a foul against one of your players was seen as much more severe and much more frequent. A foul against one of their players was seen as sort of just part of the game. It, you know, it's a contact sport. It's not that hard. And so what this study proved was that you could be at the same stadium, you could be watching the same exact television and have a completely different experience of the game. And there are thousands upon thousands of things happening within the scope of one game. We sort of, you know, especially the casual fan, would just sort of follow the ball around or whatnot. But there's so much going on. What you focus on does depend on your own biases. And again, at the subconscious level, it's not even that you're looking for these particular things. It's just sort of the way that you're conditioned to experience the game. And this also happens when it comes to commentators. I can't tell you, I actually opened up, I hosted the locker room a couple weeks back, and I opened up with "Hello and welcome to the locker room, where we hate your favorite team and love your rival." Because it's so often you get on Twitter, people assuming that you love their rival, you hate their favorite team, and in reality, you may have absolutely no interest in it. And so what happens there is similar to what these Dartmouth and Princeton fans experienced as they were watching the game. When you hear a commentator, an announcer, say something positive about one of your players, one of your teams, it doesn't quite register that strongly because it's just sort of a natural order of things. Yeah, of course, everyone should have that opinion. That player is great. My team is great. And so it's not something that's exceptionally memorable. When you hear something combative or negative about your player, your team, that sticks out. That's something you remember at the end of the game. And so when you take stock of everything you heard during the broadcast, you remember, well, this guy said all this bad stuff about my team, said all this good stuff about the other team, and you forget all of the times that they praise your players and your teams and whatnot. So that cognitive bias, that difference between sort of the reality of the event taking place and the way we perceive it, is something that absolutely fascinates me. And if I could just expand on one other little concept that I love, it's a concept of asymmetric insight. And what that means is there's a lack of symmetry between how we see others, how we see ourselves, and how we think others see us. And so what that means is we can't pay attention to every detail of everything. We need to take these cognitive shortcuts. We just don't have the brain power to focus on every detail of everything. So we have to put people in groups, right? So we do this as sports fans as well. We think, well, this person's a Juve fan, this person's a Napoli fan, that person's a Milan fan, that person's an Inter fan. And we put them into their little, you know, Inter or Milan or Juve bucket. And we throw into that bucket all of the things that we sort of associate with those fans. Now, those things may apply to them, they may not, but because we need to take these cognitive shortcuts, we'll put it in there with them. However, ourselves, we see ourselves differently. We see ourselves as individuals. We don't see ourselves as belonging to the group necessarily. Or if we do see ourselves as belonging to the group, we see ourselves as exceptions within the group. Not all of the things that go into that bucket necessarily apply to us, but we assume they do apply to them. And so that difference also is why you might have people saying really stupid things about other fan bases or jumping to conclusions about the way that, you know, a fan of a particular team will behave.
Alex, I take that back. That answer on Saturday is now my second favorite on the podcast. So fantastic. This is definitely something you're not going to hear on other podcasts. So I'm thrilled we had it here. So Dre, now everyone that listened so far is in awe of you. And let's talk a little bit about how you began your career. For me, kind of my theme song for my career, and I put that in air quotes, is AC/DC, It's a Long Way to the Top, the Rock and Roll. And I know, you know, people now know you as the voice of Serie A and BN Sport with our friend Matteo. So tell us how you got to this point. I know you certainly had to put in a lot of work and pay your dues to get there. So tell us a quick story of how you got to where you are.
Well, I wasn't a particularly good student at any point in my sort of academic career, right? So if I didn't like an assignment, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't turn in homework. I realized very, very early on that if I was going to be successful at anything, I was going to have to do something I really, really loved. Otherwise, I could not bring myself to do it. And so while I was in college, I worked as the sports director for my college radio station. I was doing basically running the entire radio sports aspect of it, calling, you know, NCAA football games, basketball games, baseball games, just carrying around my equipment everywhere. I would travel to away games. And at one game at Nacogdoches, Texas, proud home of one U.S. international, Clint Dempsey, it was a game between FIU and Stephen F. Austin. I met Phil Shane, who's our lead play-by-play commentator for La Liga. We were the only two sort of soccer junkies there, and said, you know what, when you get back to Miami, I was still in school at this time, if you're interested in, you know, starting your career in soccer, you know, give so-and-so a call and see if they've got anything for you. So I started working as a production assistant at Gold TV. I was there about 8 years, you know, worked my way up to where I was calling sort of a daily newscast Monday through Friday by the time I left there. BN Sports came about and sort of started off with this really ambitious project where they launched with Serie A, La Liga, Ligue 1, Football League Championship, World Cup qualifiers for CONCACAF and CONMEBOL. And I thought, well, I've got to get there. Like, that's going to be the next step, and I'm going to sort of try and use this as a launching pad. It's been 5 years that I've been there now. I said at the beginning of this, in 2004 when I started my career, that I was going to do this for as long as it was fun, because initially it was not very lucrative at all. But I said, you know, as long as it's fun, I'll continue to do it. And it, to this day, it just has not stopped being fun.
Awesome. So, Dre, when you and I talked on Monday, you know, you're kind of probably the last generation in a way of the old school media before there was, you know, YouTube, social media, which allowed people like knuckleheads like me to kind of get to the point where we could host this podcast with you. So looking at the change in landscape, if you were getting started in today's world, what advice would you give yourself? And this is something that a lot of the people out there that are looking to become the next Dre Cordero, I'm sure, can learn a lot from. So what advice would you give to yourself and to them?
Well, for starters, I would say aim higher than the next Dre Cordero. And secondly, there's so much opportunity now compared to when I started. And obviously, even when I started, was, you know, more a better landscape than maybe 10 years, you know, prior, where European football in particular, if that's your focus, has just absolutely blown up in the U.S. And this is probably, I mean, I do quite a bit of travel. This is probably the best place on the planet to watch broadcast games. The amount of football that we have on TV is incredible. And the resources that you have to get started to find your voice are, you know, unparalleled for any other generation. I mean, think about it. YouTube is only 12 years old. YouTube started in 2005. I started my career around 2003, 2004. Podcasts have exploded. I would say, you know, for anyone who wants to get in, don't wait on anything. Sure, you might be trying to get in at BN Sports, at ESPN, at Fox. But in the meantime, get to work. You know, upload as many, you know, podcasts as you can. Upload as many YouTube videos as you can. Because it's going to take a while to find your voice. And you're going, I mean, anyone who's recorded your voice at any point was immediately embarrassed by the sound of their own voice the very first time. It takes a while to get used to that. It takes a while to see yourself on camera. And so there's all these opportunities to get started today that you don't have to wait for anything else. You just need a camera or a microphone or, you know, a WordPress site. So start making mistakes, because it's the only way to learn is from making mistakes. You have to dive in head first now. And while chasing the traditional route, if you'd like, you can take these new forms of media, this sort of citizen journalism explosion, and use it to your advantage.
Dre, I am absolutely blown away. I had high expectations after we talked on Monday, and you were absolutely fantastic. So I want to thank you so much for coming on. I'm already looking forward to our next chat, as long as you're willing to come back on. So thank you so much for doing this.
Hey, you're too kind, David. I had a blast. Thanks so much.